Mark of the American Council on Education, brought to you by Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
So when you get to the corner of Smith and Orchard, you're going to want to take a left.
You are not going to.
Then what you're
going to
do is turn onto Marcy Avenue.
Just broke up,
and go past the first three lights, and then take the next left.
I don't really
think she's
happy,
more blocks,
but
and you should be there.
Who am I to judge, right?
Park on the right.
I'll see you later tonight.
It's hard to concentrate on two things at once, like texting and driving. Stop the text, stop the wrecks. How will you stop texting and driving? Tell us at StopTextStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
2013 summer semester at Henry Ford Community College is fast approaching. Now is the time to register. This summer, the semester will start June 25th and will last through August 12th. For more information on registering for the summer, go to www.hfcc.edu. Once again, that is www.hfcc.edu. It's that time of year. Time to register at Henry Ford Community College for the 2013 fall semester. Most of the classes that you will take at Henry Ford Community College will transfer to major four-year institutions in the area. Also, HFCC has some of the lowest tuition rates around. First-time students can go to the Welcome Center on campus. Call 800-585-HFCC or go to the web at www.hfcc.edu for more information. Fall semester starts August 22nd, so register today to get the best choice for classes. See you there.
Hello, I'm Michael Intiman.
I'm Michael Hayball.
And I'm Elena from Moldova.
We host a show called Noise Pollution.
It is every Wednesday from 8 to 10 at night.
We are on the only station that is making waves,
WHFR.
Wait, how come I'm not in on the whole Unison thing?
Because you're not down with the groove.
And what does that mean?
WHFR.
You guys are really doing this?
We're like the Beavis and Butthead of the radio.
Then what does that make me?
What do you mean?
There are two guys, Beavis and Butthead.
No.
Don't you talk down to us.
But you have three people on the show.
Let me see if your math is right here.
This may take a while.
So my question is...
We're holding our breath.
If you guys are Beavis and Butthead, then what does that make me?
You can be Stewart.
I don't think I feel as excited about this as you guys do.
That's Noise Pollution.
On the only station that's making waves,
WHFR.
The views and opinions expressed on the following pre-recorded show do not necessarily represent those of WHFR or Henry Ford Community College. Good afternoon. This is WHFR Dearborn. You're listening to the program called Metaphysically Speaking. I'm your host, Mike Holloway. This month, my special guest is Kathy Juris. She is a professor of sociology at Oakland and Macomb Community Colleges. She is also actively involved in HIV prevention and education, along with being the director of Stitches Women's Initiatives, which is an organization dealing with women's health and safety issues. With all that being said, I want to say, hi, Kathy, how are you?
Well, I'm doing great today. Nice weather out there.
Yeah, very, very nice. Sounds like you're a very busy woman.
Yes, indeed.
Is that good?
I'm very, very busy. It is good. I like to be as busy as possible when I'm physically able to be. Mm-hmm. So I always try to take advantage of that when mm-hmm. I'm doing well.
Right, when you have your strength,
that's right,
so to speak.
That's right.
First of all, I do want to thank you also for being a part of our recent Holistic Fair, the Festival of Enlightenment. Thank you very much for being a part
sure.
of that.
It was
we
a pleasure.
It.
Yeah, it was great. Met a lot of really cool people.
Yeah, well, that's good. That's a plus, right?
Yes.
Now, we often talk about things of spirit on this show, but we also sometimes think about holistic things and speak about holistic things having to do with the body itself. And for this particular show, that's what we're going to be doing, is speaking about a physical ailment. Kathy is a HIV-positive person. Do you want to tell us how that all came about? I mean, when it happened and how?
Sure. Well, it happened many, many moons ago. I got married when I was 25 to a man who was born with hemophilia. which is, for those people who don't know, it's a bleeding disorder. Your blood doesn't clot properly. So you can have spontaneous bleeds anywhere in your body, into your joints, which causes extreme pain and crippling. Can get bleeds into your brain, obviously, which could cause a whole lot of other problems, even death.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a very, very positive person. And when I met him, I knew that he was my soulmate, and we were meant to be together. So it didn't matter that he had hemophilia, you know. His attitude was, you know, they're going to cure this in my lifetime. And, you know, we don't really have to worry about it. And so I said, okay, if you're okay with that, then I'm okay with that. What neither of us knew at the time is that was, I met him in 1981, was the beginning of what we obviously found out later to be the contamination of our blood supply here in the United States. With what is now called HIV, because mm-hmm. at that time they didn't even, you know, have
right,
a name for
right.
it, and I couldn't identify it, in fact, in the very beginning. So we didn't know about that. And, of course, Michael had been exposed to the blood supply his whole life, because that's how the only way they had to treat hemophilia when he was younger was using whole blood transfusion. So he spent most of his childhood in the hospital, being hooked up to, you know, transfusions for weeks and weeks and months on end, sometimes till the bleeding would stop. So he didn't have, you know, a normal childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And so, unbeknownst to either of us, as I said, he had been exposed then to HIV through the blood products in the blood supply. When he became a teenager, they had developed blood products called factor concentrates, because that's what they're missing in their blood, certain factors that cause it to clot. And those products were made from human blood also. So those very medications then that he was taught to inject into his own body, those were contaminated with HIV as well. So he became infected, didn't know. Obviously, we got married in 1983 and wanted to start a family. So obviously, you know, we were having unprotected sex.
Mm-hmm.
In order for me to get pregnant, I did get pregnant. We had our daughter a year later in 84. 3 months after she was born, I got incredibly ill, sicker than I had ever been in my whole life. And I was breastfeeding my daughter. I had to stop breastfeeding her so that I could take, you know, medications, because I wasn't going to, you know, take something that would obviously get passed on to her through the breast
mm-hmm.
milk. So I had to wean her. I was on medication. Finally got better after, you know, I don't know, it took like a month and a half. I mean, I was really sick. But, you know, I didn't really think anything about it, and there was no reason that I would think it was something unusual, right? I had been an extremely nerdy person growing up, and I was not sexually active till I got married, so
mm-hmm.
I had no reason to believe that I would be at risk for anything, you know, anything
right.
weird or
no
bizarre.
No drugs whatsoever.
Right. Never did mm-hmm. anything like that. Very
right.
straight-laced person. So in the end of, let's see, that was 84, Stephanie was born. So in the beginning of 1985, my husband was contacted through the Hemophilia Treatment Center, which was at Children's Hospital of Michigan in Detroit. They asked if we would take part in a national study that was being done called the Transfusion Safety Study. And my husband was used to being studied because as a hemophiliac, you see doctors all the time. You have to go in for care all the time. So they're a really good group of people to have in, you know, growth studies and dental studies and things like that, which is, you know, so he was used to that. So he said, sure, we'll take part in a study if it can help, you know, medical science.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And since I had never had a transfusion in my life, right,
mm-hmm.
I had no reason to be concerned, right? It's a transfusion safety study, and that's all we kind of knew, right? They didn't know anything else. They said that our daughter, who was at that point, obviously she was just a baby, you know, an infant, that her and myself and my husband would all be our blood would be tested, and we'd be asked, you know, questions, like a series of questions, and then they would follow up with us every 6 months, for whatever period of time, you know. And we said, okay, that's fine.
Were you still sick at this time?
No. No, I was fine. Mm-hmm. I was all better. And so we did that. Went down there, got some blood drawn. You know, no big deal. My daughter, I mean, that was the worst part because she was a baby. She didn't really like the whole getting her blood drawn part.
Right.
And then they put Michael in one room, and I was in another room, and they started asking us these series of questions. And when they started asking me questions about how my husband and I had sex, the kinds of sex that we had, and all kinds of other weird kind of questions about where I'd been and if I'd gone traveling, and I mean, all kinds of different, I was like, I just thought it was really bizarre. Like, what does that have to do with a transfusion?
Right.
You know what I mean? I mean, I'm not a doctor or a biologist or, you know, or anything like that, but I think I'm fairly smart, you know, and I couldn't figure out the connection, right? So when I got out of there, I remember saying to my husband as we're driving home, you know, like, what kind of questions did they ask you? And he told me, and I'm like, yeah, isn't that weird? Like, what are they asking us about? He said, I don't really know. Well, that was in the beginning of 85. And they told us we'd get in touch with this, like in 6 months, and they'd do this again. Well, being again the nerd ball that I am, 6 months went by and we didn't hear from them. So, you know, one day I called on there and I said, hey, you know, it's been more than 6 months. Aren't you guys going to follow up or blah, 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 you know, whatever. And they said, oh, yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, we need you guys to come down, all of you. You, Michael, and the baby. Just come on down and we'll talk about it. I'm like, okay. That didn't sound really...
Mm-hmm. Sounded grim.
Yeah, it didn't sound good. I mean, I didn't think... Again, I didn't think the worst because I couldn't imagine what could be that bad.
For you personally.
But still, I mean, we had no knowledge of HIV even at that point, right? Mm-hmm. Because it really wasn't out in the news then. Okay? So we went down there and they put us in the little teeny little room. One of those small little examining rooms with just like the stretcher in there, you know? And we were sitting on the little cot there with Stephanie, and when the door opened and 7 medical staff people came in, filed into this teeny little room and were blocking the exit door, I knew it was really bad news. I didn't know what it was, but I knew it was bad. And the first thing they said is, what do you want? Do you want the good news or the bad news first? Okay. And I'm like, since I wasn't expecting really bad news, I said, give me the good news. Well, the good news is what we tested you guys for is something called HIV that causes something called AIDS, you know. And we tested it, and your daughter, Stephanie, who was at that point a year and a half old, she tested negative. But we don't know if she'll remain negative. You're going to have to get her tested every year for the next 5 years to make sure she's okay. That was the good news. The bad news, of course, you know, they said you and Michael have both been infected with this thing. You are HIV positive. We don't really know what that means. Because of the way that he was exposed through the blood supply for the blood products, maybe it's actually a protective thing. That's what they actually told us. Maybe you guys are actually protected from this thing, which is probably the worst thing they could have said, okay? Because they didn't know then. So we, you know, the only thing I remember, there was a couple things, you know, because everything else was just black. They said, don't tell anybody, okay? Don't tell anybody else because there were already bad things happening to people once people found out they were HIV positive. You know, and as you recall, perhaps, you know, Ryan White, you know, the little boy, the little hemophiliac, in Indiana, who had, you know, they came by and drove by and shot, you know, through his window in his house, and they had to move to another town. And then there was the Ray brothers, who were also 3 young boys with hemophilia down in Florida, Arcadia, Florida, that people burned their house down and they had to move. So it really was not, you know, a time where you wanted to let people know you had HIV because there was so much hysteria about it.
Right.
And there wasn't any really good information. You know, there was a lot of questions, but no answers. So don't tell anyone. Okay, fine. I can certainly keep my mouth shut about that. You and your husband should probably not have sex anymore. You should live like brother and sister. Okay, we had just gotten married. My daughter was a year and a half old, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was 27. And because we think re-exposing each other to this virus is probably not a good thing. And so, you know, you either have to live like brother and sister or you always have to use protection. Probably better if you don't have sex at all. Okay, well, that was great. That was, again, another highlight of the conversation. And then they said, and, you know, you don't tell anybody about this, but you should probably try to find someone who could raise your daughter in the event that you both die, because most people who have this, who are HIV positive, usually live between 18 months to 2 years.
Wow. They just dropped the bomb on you, huh?
Yeah. And I was 27.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when people ask me how I felt, I all I can remember is being totally numb, you know, just numb. How do you, and then they ask, do you have any questions? Well, you know, clearly I had like 3 million questions, but I couldn't form sentences in my head. You know, I was just blown out of the water. And I was not expecting anything like that at all. So they, again, took Michael out of the room. He went in another room. They're going to draw our blood. They came, I was by myself with another woman in another room. And as soon as she closed the door, she said to me, so, are you okay? And I started sobbing. I'm like, of course I'm not okay. How could I be okay? Mm-hmm. And how am I going to continue my life? And do I need to find somebody now to give my daughter to? Because, you know, they couldn't even answer the question about whether or not she was at risk by living with us. Mm-hmm. You know, when your baby's young, you know, you test their bottles. You know, if you're warming up their food, you test their food. You put it in your mouth. You know, you test it to make sure it's not too hot, and all of those things. And if they couldn't tell me that that kind of stuff wasn't going to infect my daughter, then you know, I got to do something, right? And how do you do that without telling anybody? So it was a very, very scary, dark time. Mm-hmm. There was a whole lot of fear. Certainly for myself, you know, my own mortality, but there was fear from, you know, everybody, right? The whole world, you know, because it became more and more, you know, known and how bad it was. And what I found out about the transfusion safety study was it was a prevalence study that they wanted to do. They wanted to see, because they figured out that when they finally saw, you know, it wasn't just gay men, there were, you know, drug users that, you know, had come, and there was people from Haiti that had it, and then all of a sudden these hemophiliacs had it.
Right.
So they kind of took it back to, oh, it's got to be somehow bloodborne pathogen. Let's check the blood supply. Because the people who use it all the time, hemophiliacs, right, would be the ones that would show up if it was in the blood supply. And that's exactly what they found out, that out of all the hemophiliacs that they tested, over 90% of them were HIV positive.
Wow.
From the blood products, yeah.
Wow. It's amazing, and not in a good way, obviously.
No, not in a good way. So I was so angry when I found out, because I'm like, why didn't you tell us when you found out? They wouldn't have, if I didn't call them to say, hey, what's the story, I would have never heard anything, okay? And the answer was, well, it was a prevalence study. We just wanted to know how much stuff was out there. So clearly there was nothing they could do for you. There was no medication.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was very little information, really, at that time. So they just sent us home and said, yeah, we'll see you again in 6 months, and we'll draw your blood, and we'll check your levels and stuff again. In the meantime, you know.
Yeah, just deal with it.
Deal with it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bye.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very quickly, I just want to say this is WHFR.FM, the station making waves. You're listening to Metaphysically Speaking. I'm your host, Mike Holloway. This month, my special guest is Kathy Juris, and she is a professor of sociology at Oakland and Macomb Community Colleges. She is also actively involved in HIV prevention and education, along with being the director of Stitches Women's Initiatives, which is an organization dealing with women's health and safety issues. So getting back to your story, how did it turn out for your daughter? Is she still negative? I mean, did that turn out good for her at least?
Yeah. Yes, I mean, the upside is that, and of course we know more now, that people seroconvert that's when you go from being negative to positive,
mm-hmm.
In a relatively quick period of time, you know, usually within less than a month. from the time of being exposed to it. So they didn't know that back then, okay? So my daughter, you know, is not HIV positive. But if you were to talk to my daughter about this issue, she did not look at that as a lucky thing at all, because from her point of view, and she knew this at a very, very young age, even though we, you know, we didn't like sit down and tell her then. Obviously, she was only a year and a half old, right? But she was the only person we could talk in front of for years, right?
Right.
So she knew that we had something, you know, in our blood, in our bodies, that was probably going to kill us. And there was nothing we could do about it. And so when she got, I remember when she was in like first grade, she started to have the separation anxiety stuff. Like at the end of the school day, she would start crying because she kind of knew, right? If she didn't see my car pull up, you know, to pick her up, something must be wrong, you know, something's wrong with my mom. And so, luckily, her first grade teacher was an awesome lady. But it got worse, because then it wasn't only the 5 minutes before parents were coming, but then it was a half an hour before school ended, and then it was an hour before school ended. She would start, you know, it was really, really hard on her. And at one point, she said to me and my husband, she said, "You know, I really wish that I had HIV too, because I don't want to." I don't want you guys to die, and I'll be here all by myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is your little kid telling you
right.
that. So, even though she wasn't infected with the virus, her whole life was affected, you know, by AIDS and the shadow of death, and she had to watch her dad, you know, get sick and die, and he died when she was only 8.
Mm-hmm.
And she just got married last July, you know, when she was 28. So 20 years after her dad is gone, you know what I mean?
It's, right.
It has had a profound impact on my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And it has made her a really, really strong person. But she has paid dearly for the wisdom, you know, and the insight that she has.
Mm-hmm. Well, how is it you survived all this time? I mean, how did you seem to make it through?
I don't know. I don't know. You know, I have people tell me that it's, you know, it's my attitude. You know, it's because I've turned it into a positive thing to try to educate
mm-hmm.
people.
Well, there again, you said your husband was positive, though, too. I mean,
he was, but remember, he had been exposed to the blood supply his whole life. So mm-hmm. he didn't only get HIV from the blood supply. They got hepatitis, people with hemophilia. They got parvovirus. They got anything that was in the blood supply, they got exposed to.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the people with hemophilia, they really didn't have a fighting chance. I've always been, I was a sickly kid, you know, when I was younger. I had asthma, like really horrible, debilitating asthma when I was little. I also have a fatal nut allergy, so I've almost died numerous times from anaphylaxis.
Wow.
but in general, I've been a very healthy person, okay?
Yeah, other than a few things.
And I've been a very athletic person. Okay. So, you know, so perhaps that's part of it. I don't know. I think I have to say, I think luck is a big part of it, and timing, because my husband got sick, started to get sick, I should say, before there was really any good, medication that had been developed.
Right.
And then he ended up getting, you know, AIDS is not one thing, right? AIDS is a syndrome. So you get one of, there's, I think, 27 specific illnesses,
right.
You know, on the list that the CDC has. And he happened to get, of course, one of them that, you know, you can't fix, and that's lymphoma. And because he was already severely immune suppressed, he couldn't do chemo, you know, the things
right.
that they would normally try
right.
for somebody mm-hmm. with lymphoma. So he really, like I said, the timing and stuff, you know, was bad. And I look back on his life, and it makes me cry, because, you know, his whole beginning of his life, he spent in the hospital
mm-hmm.
dealing with his hemophilia. And then when he was a teenager, because they've developed these blood products, he thought, wow, finally I have independence, you know, and I can go somewhere, you know, go away, and I can take this medication with me, and I can, you know, infuse myself, and I, you know, so it was like a whole new hope for people mm-hmm. with hemophilia. And then that very thing that gave them hope is the thing that took their lives away. I mean, it's so tragic, mm-hmm. you know. And I could have, and I was in that spot for a long time. I have to tell you, Mike, I was sad, and I was really, really angry for a long time. But that doesn't do me any good, and I couldn't do that to my daughter. I couldn't do it. The day that her dad died, she said to me, again, I've learned so much from my daughter. She said, Mom, will you promise me that you won't die and leave me here by myself? And of course, you know, I couldn't promise her that. And so I told her that. I said, I can't promise you I won't die, but I will promise you that I will do everything in my power, everything humanly possible, to stay as healthy as I can for as long as I can. And if that means, you know, experimental medication, I don't care what it means. I will try everything. And I have. I've tried a lot of alternative things, you know, massage and acupuncture, you know, and herbal things. I mean, I've tried tons of stuff. And I did go into a phase one trials, AIDS drugs trial, which was scary, really mm-hmm. scary. And I would not ever advise anybody to go into a phase one trial because that's right after the monkeys and the dogs.
Yeah,
okay?
Right.
First human trials. So it did some damage right. To my body.
Guinea pigs, so
yeah,
to speak.
Yeah, literally. Mm-hmm. But that is the promise I made to her. So I believe that my daughter is what has kept me around this long. Mm-hmm. I needed to be here for her. And she deserved that, you know. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, last year seeing her get married, you know, I never thought I would live that long.
Right.
You know, never thought I would live that long. I was 27 when I was diagnosed, and mm-hmm. they said 18 months to 2 years. And I've had this virus now in my body for more than half my life. Mm-hmm. You know, we're old friends.
Yeah.
HIV and
you know
I are old friends.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of, I wrote a letter to my virus many, many years ago as part of a weekend retreat that they did for people with HIV. And I wrote a letter to it and said, you know, let's just agree to live together. You know, you don't kill me and I won't kill you. Let's just kind of, you know.
Coexist.
Yes, coexist. And that's, and I actually think that way, you know.
So in other words, you've come to terms with it?
Yeah,
I
have.
You think?
I have, actually. It's not, HIV is not the worst thing that could happen to somebody.
Okay.
And I'm saying that, I'm not saying that I'm not, you know, trying to be glib or anything. I have seen and heard and read such horrifying stories about things that have happened to people, you know, both in this country and worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I started my Women's Initiatives Project, because of some of these things, you know, that happen to women. They don't have, when you don't have power, you don't have any access to reproductive health, things like that. You know, you live in a patriarchal society. When you don't have that, lots of horrible things can happen to you mm-hmm. just because of your gender.
Right.
I'm extremely blessed that I live in the United States of America, that I have health insurance, okay, and that I have a family full of people who loved me regardless of that I had HIV or not.
Mm-hmm.
They never turned their backs on me like happened to many, many people.
Right.
So I have had many things that have helped me still be here, you know, this many years later. I'll be 56 in December, you know. I have gray hair, you know.
Right.
I never thought
never
I'd see
thought
it.
You, yeah, you'd be here.
Yeah,
so
I know that, and I think
yeah.
that's part of it, is I know that it could be much, much worse.
Right. You embrace you know? Age at this point.
I do. Oh, I love mm-hmm. it.
Right.
I like the wrinkles and the gray
right.
hair. And
right. Everybody complains about getting older. You don't,
I
though,
don't.
Right?
Yeah. I don't. I always mm-hmm. tell them, consider the alternative.
That's right. It's all relative,
that's
right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
And quickly, once again, I just want to remind everybody that this is WHFR Data FM, the station making waves. This show is Metaphysically Speaking. I'm Mike Holloway. And my special guest this month is Kathy Juris. and she is a professor of sociology at Oakland and Macomb Community College, and she is also actively involved in HIV prevention and education, along with being the director of Stitches Women's Initiatives, which is an organization dealing with women's health and safety issues. Now, what do you say if somebody, and I don't know if anybody has ever said this to you, but what do they say if something to the effect that there are no accidents in life or anything, everything happens for a reason? What do you say to that?
Well, I've had people tell me when I've said, you know, I don't know why I'm still here kind of thing, you know, and they say, well, you're here for a reason. You're doing something that's really important that not a lot of people can do or would want to do, you know, educating about these issues, because it's hard. When I'm doing HIV education, I'm putting myself and my life out there for people to criticize, to comment on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had some pretty nasty comments from people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the individuals who think that, you know, AIDS is some kind of punishment, you know, from
right.
God,
mm-hmm.
for whatever. I don't believe that.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of have to agree. I don't necessarily think that things happen as a mistake or something.
Yeah,
think
they happen for a reason.
I do think they happen for a reason. I can tell you for sure that I'm a very different person today because of HIV.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine learning the lessons that I've learned in any other way. Do you
mm-hmm.
know what I mean?
Right.
I, as a young person, I thought everything was black and white, you know,
mm-hmm.
right and wrong. And I was very judgmental of a lot of, you know, other people.
Mm-hmm.
And what I have learned, the lessons I've learned because of AIDS, because of HIV, I'm a totally different person now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a very good thing. So HIV has been a teacher to me. Do I wish, would I have preferred learning it in a different way? Yeah, I would
right.
say yes.
Mm-hmm.
I think I could have gone without a lot of these, you know, horrible side effects from medications
right.
and other kinds of procedures that I've had to have done because of the side effects,
mm-hmm.
operations, cancer, you know, cervical cancer, which is one of the AIDS-defining illnesses when you have HIV, shingles that I also had, which is another one of the AIDS-defining illnesses. Yeah, I probably could have gotten by without all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I think if you talk to anybody that deals with health issues, many people will tell you that. Or other challenges, like blindness and, you know, things like that. They'll tell you. Like, it makes them who they are. And I guess that's the best thing I could answer to that question.
Mm-hmm. Well, getting to the point, though, where you reached a certain time in your life where you just decided that I really have to do something positive to educate people, to do something positive. How many years was that before you reached that point?
Well, my husband passed away in 1992. And I had already been working at a local agency doing HIV prevention education since January of 1990.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gotten connected with them through the Hemophilia Foundation of Michigan because, again, they had to get involved in HIV work because so many of their patients, you know, were infected. So that was kind of my entree, you know, into education in regards to HIV. And I knew, and my husband felt the same way. He tried to do everything he could to educate people before he passed. He wanted people to understand, you know, that this was not something that people asked for, no matter how you got HIV.
Right.
I mean, yes, it's a sexually transmitted disease. Yeah, it is. Okay. And most people in the whole world who have it got it, but they got it through heterosexual intercourse, which is between a man and a woman. There's still lots of people that think it's really only a gay disease and only gay people have to worry about it. And that was never, ever true.
Mm-hmm.
Because anytime something is a sexually transmitted disease, that means anybody can get it.
Right.
Right? It's fair game, right? Equal opportunity virus, you know?
Yeah, if you want to look at it that way.
Well, it is.
Yeah.
And so,
no, you're right.
So I think, that whole issue of trying to educate people and let them understand the reality of what it is. And nowadays, we don't hear about HIV as much. So it's really, I think, even more important to talk about it. And I'm so happy that you invited me on your show. Because the only time you hear about it now is if somebody famous, you know, happens to, you know, come out and say, oh, you know, I have HIV, right? People think it's been cured, right? Oh, there's medications, you know, there's all this good stuff.
Right.
There's all kinds of research. I'm sure it's not really a problem anymore. And you have people saying it's manageable. It's like diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, you know what? It's not like diabetes. I understand the idea that if you can take some, you know, you can take some medication and treatment, and there are people that can, you can keep your virus low in your body, you can keep your immune system, you know, on a hopefully a healthy level, like, say, Magic Johnson, you know, which is obviously the most famous person that
right.
I know
right.
who has HIV.
Well, Arthur Ashe was another famous person
sure.
as well.
And unfortunately, he died, I
right.
think, quickly.
Yeah, fairly soon after he came out.
Yeah, after he came out. Mm-hmm. Where Magic is still around and he's still doing well. And like I said, there's a lot of hopeful things for people with HIV. Okay,
right.
So it's not the same. If you got diagnosed today, right, infected and diagnosed today, it's not the same story. Okay, as it was back in the, you know, in the early days, in the 80s when my husband and I were exposed and infected and, you know, found out and there was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So people need to understand that too, is that there are things you can do, first of all, to protect yourself so you don't get infected in the first place. But if you do get infected, you know, there's medications out there, there's support groups, you know what I mean? There's doctors that know what they're dealing with. And so it's a very different story. And, you know, lots of people, when they would get the news that they were HIV positive, would commit suicide
mm-hmm.
because
right.
they didn't understand, you
well,
know.
Yeah.
So we still have to talk about it. And the new infection rate
mm-hmm.
is still high.
Right.
So it's not that everybody knows what they're supposed to do and they're not getting infected anymore. No, that's
mm-hmm.
not true because right. we're not allowed to do education in schools. You can't talk about sex. Well, if you can't talk about sex, then you can't talk about HIV.
Right.
Because that's how it's passed.
Well, especially in third world countries, too, it's a terrible problem still.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
And because of the different cultures, I'm a sociologist, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because of the different cultural traditions and stuff that they have there, and again, this strong patriarchal society where the men basically kind of own the women. Women don't really have any rights of their own. They couldn't use condoms or something if they wanted to, you know, if they had access to them, because it's not up to them. It's not their choice. So we have, and then also where, you know, men, if they go away from their, say, their village or whatever, they go away for work, it is perfectly reasonable in their, again, culture that while they're in the big city, that they're going to visit prostitutes, okay, and then come back home, right, and have sex with their wife as well. So there's, you know, the same kinds of discussions, you know, about safe sex and stuff don't work there because the culture is very different. And so you have to, so it's about educating, you know, re-educating people about what they need to know and the kinds of things that are putting everybody at risk, but in this particular case, that are specifically putting women at risk, girls
mm-hmm.
and women. And young marriage, you know, when they marry off girls very, very young, same kind of thing. In India, oh my God, the stories that you hear from a global perspective, just horrific. And that's the stories that our dolls tell from the Doll Project, the Stitches Women's Initiative Doll Project. We have now about 20 dolls from India.
Mm-hmm.
And when you read the stories of those dolls and you compare them to some of the stories that are written by, you know, women and girls from the United States, you can see how this whole idea of that women don't have any value there.
Mm-hmm.
They are like possessions. And if they do something wrong, they are literally thrown into the street. If they're found out to be sick, somehow they're thrown into the street and nobody helps them. Their families turn their backs on them because they've shamed their families. Mm-hmm. Now, again, all the young girls that have gotten infected that we've read about, the ones that we have, the dolls that we have from India, were all either sexually abused by a family member, even before they were married, right? Or forced to do other things to people, you know, even once they were married. I mean, it's just, the stories are mind-boggling. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as I said, as an educator about HIV, I feel that we can't talk about it enough, and we need to be frank and honest and open about it. In other words, you have to talk about sex, you have to use the words, because otherwise you're not doing anybody any favors. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not helping people to change their behavior, which is what we really need to do if you want to protect people. And the people that we are seeing the biggest spike of new infections are young people, mm-hmm. 13 to 24. And the other group that we see big spike in, guess who? Seniors.
That's
people over 50.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay? Yeah, because nobody's telling them. They don't think, right? Oh, I don't have to worry about that, right?
Right.
I'm older. I don't need to worry about that. Well, anybody could have it, and you can't tell by looking at them, right? So everybody should know, you know, what they need to do to keep themselves protected, you know? And the only way to do that is to be able to talk to people honestly about it.
Mm-hmm. Once again, I just want to remind everybody that this is WHFR.FM, the station making waves. This program is Metaphysically Speaking. I'm your host, Mike Holloway. My special guest this month is Kathy Juris. She is a professor of sociology at Oakland and Macomb Community Colleges. She is also actively involved in HIV prevention and education, along with being the director of Stitches Women's Initiatives, which is an organization dealing with women's health and safety issues. Let's hear a little bit about your organization. How did that start? How did that come about?
Oh, okay. Well, as I mentioned earlier, I started working in 1990 for an organization called the Midwest AIDS Prevention Project in Ferndale. And in the last several years, they've undergone a little transformation, and now it's called Michigan AIDS Coalition. So mm-hmm. I don't want people to get confused. Same organization. And so I was working there, and we were doing HIV prevention work at businesses and colleges and universities, and sometimes in high schools. And it depended on what high school you went to as to what you were allowed to say, you know, what words you're allowed to use. In many places, most places, in fact, you couldn't use the word condom. You couldn't say that. And students would ask questions. Students would raise their hand, right, and say, you know, like, well, what about condoms, or what about, you know, oral sex or something like that. They would say something like that. And of course, you know, I'm the person, like, I'm a mom, okay? My daughter was very, very well educated growing up, okay? I did not want her to,
right,
you know, have something happen to her, right? Because I was too shy to talk to her about sex or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. So from my point of view, I think we owe it to people to educate them. So as well, I was at that agency, and I was at the time on President Clinton's HIV/AIDS Advisory Council. I was a volunteer position. I met numerous other women from around the country who were HIV positive, and I would come home, and I would tell my coworker Candace, who worked with me at the agency, and we would talk about the stories of these women. And she goes, you know, we've got to find some way, you know, to do some outreach to women, because there was no messages developed for women. There were messages for gay men, right? Men who have sex with men, sure. There was outreach to homeless people. There was outreach to drug users.
Drug addicts, right.
But there was nobody talking to women. And if you did hear somebody say anything about women, they would say, you know, just don't have sex till you get married and then you'll be fine. Well, as a person, myself, who had not been sexually active before I was married, and got married and got infected, I knew that labels like I'm married don't protect you.
Right.
So we finally came up with an idea of using dolls as a vehicle for women to tell their stories about how they got infected or whatever they wanted to tell. You know, I mean, some women talk about how they got infected. Other women talk, they have messages about, you know, using, like, being safe, using safe sex, or, you know, other things, or messages of hope, or spiritual messages to people. So the dolls say whatever they want to say, because the women, we do the workshops. We bring the dolls. We bring all the materials that you need to make a doll. And as they're making the doll, we ask them the one question, which is, if your doll could talk, what would she say? What would she want to tell people? You know, you have this opportunity, because they know the doll, they don't get to keep the doll. It comes to me and becomes part of a traveling exhibit, which, you know, educates the greater community. So we have found that the dolls can get into places where HIV-positive people can't,
mm-hmm.
you know, because many of the dolls are very, very beautiful, you know. Some of them are stark also. Some of them are very stark and sad mm-hmm. dolls. But more often than not, they're stunningly beautiful dolls.
Mm-hmm.
And they all have extremely important messages. So these women have taken the time out of their life to create a piece of art that will educate other people and reach through, and it crosses all the lines. You know, it breaks down the barriers of age and race and religion and gender.
Right. Well, that's the thing. It's just not one particular group getting it. I mean, it could be anybody, anytime, anywhere.
Exactly. Oh, exactly. And that's what the dolls bring up, all those issues, because they talk about, for instance, domestic violence, somebody getting infected that way. They talk about substance use, okay? Talk about, you know, it talks about, some of them talk about incest. You know, they bring up all the issues that put people, not just women, but people in general, at risk. And that is the beauty of the project. I mean, it's extremely powerful when you get to witness a display of the dolls. And I would love to have an opportunity where we could do a large display that could be there for a while, you know, because it's hard when you're at an event and it's only a day-long event, right? You can't bring 100 dolls, you know what I mean? You can only bring a couple, you know, you can only bring a few. But if people truly had the opportunity to experience the dolls the way that I get to experience them, because I know all those dolls personally. They come to my house, and my sister and I are the ones that enter them all into the computer and take the photographs and put them up on the website. And so even though I've not met every single one of these women in person, because some of these, you know, workshops take place in, you know, in other areas, we make it happen, but I don't necessarily get to meet all these women. I feel like I know them.
Mm-hmm.
And on a very intimate level, you know, as I said, they've shared a piece of their life and they've done it for the sole purpose of educating other people.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel this is therapeutic for women to get this type of information out, to actually display what they're feeling and what they're
yes.
thinking?
Yeah, it's absolutely. We do comment cards. We get information back from them, feedback, and overwhelmingly, they say, you know, and some of them is the first time they've ever been able to say it out loud that they had HIV, because in their everyday lives, it's not maybe safe, you know, to let people know that they have HIV, depending on where they live or what their situation is. It's very empowering to them because they know the doll is going on to educate other people. And as you know, most of the women, well, probably worldwide, but I'll just speak about the United States right now, that women that are infected with HIV are women who are disenfranchised already. You know, they're poor, right? Inner city, largely inner city. People of color, minorities. Okay? So it's not people that are famous and have the whole world at their feet, right?
Mm-hmm. Or the money that
right.
they need.
Right. So these are people that nobody cares about. And when they get an opportunity, somebody comes to them and says, you know, make a doll that says whatever you want it to say, and it's going to go and educate other people, yeah, that's very, very empowering. And that's exactly what they tell us. One woman, my mom and I went, my mom is one of my other biggest volunteer helpers, and we went down to Cleveland, Ohio, drove down there to do a doll workshop in the middle of a January snowstorm several years back. And, you know, we were only there 2 hours. It was a two-hour, you know, workshop. And at the end of the 2 hours, this one woman, who was an African-American woman, small little lady came up to my mom and just gave her this gigantically big hug. And she said to my mom, "This was the best day of my life making this doll. This is the first time anybody has ever asked me what I thought or felt about anything." The best day of her life, mm-hmm. making a doll. Again, very, very humbling, right?
Right. No, that's fantastic.
That, you know, for this woman, whatever her circumstances are, right, that meant that much to her. You know, this, like I said, it's very powerful for the women who make the dolls and also for the people who get to view them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. But going forward, I mean, the more women you reach, obviously the better it is, because more people are aware of what the consequences are and possibly, hopefully, how to protect themselves mm-hmm. and how to make things better.
Yeah, well, I think the best thing we can do is educate people, no matter what the issues are,
mm-hmm.
you know. I think that's the, you know, and I'm not just saying that because I'm an educator.
Right.
But, I mean, I truly believe that when you don't know about something, that's when it's a problem.
Right.
Right. So the more you know about it, you know, the better off you are. And that's true about HIV. It's true about domestic violence. It's true about, you know, everything. And I'm speaking now as a sociologist, right? We can change the world, but we have to be willing to change our minds first. And if we don't know about something, right, then we're just going to keep doing the same old thing. And we're going to end up with the same old thing. And that isn't working really well for us. You know, I think our world is in sad shape. You know, I look at the way that they treat women, as I said, in general, is exactly how we treat the environment. You know, it's throwaway. Mm-hmm. Just use it up and then throw it away. Okay. So, you know, I mean, I'm kind of sounding like, you know, I'm not meaning to sound like I know I have the answer to everything. I don't. But I do know that education is key. And it has to be honest, frank education. Not walking around, prancing around the bush,
right.
You know.
Or sweeping it under
right,
the carpet,
right.
So
people,
to speak.
And young people especially, want to know. They want to know. They always ask. You know, so we need to be better parents. You know, we have to. We have to do things that maybe make us uncomfortable because it will save our children's lives. That's our jobs, right, as parents. We need to give our kids the information they need so that they don't end up in a bad place. I wouldn't wish having HIV on anybody, which is why I continue to do this, you know, as much as I can. Whenever I can.
Right. Well, again, like you said earlier, you wouldn't wish it on anybody. You wish you would not have had to have gone through it, but it's a very traumatic journey. I mean, like you said earlier, when they first diagnosed this, it was pretty much a death sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, I'm sure some people probably just went ahead and killed themselves because what do they have to live for?
Yeah.
You know, let's end it now rather than suffer for the next 2-3 years, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Now, as a person, do you feel that medical advancements are happening so that things are getting better?
Well, there's been some actually very interesting and very good news coming out of some of the research and things that have been done. I don't know if you heard about the Berlin patient, but that was a gentleman who had HIV and leukemia.
Mm-hmm.
And his doctor was able to find a donor for, you know, bone marrow, stem cell donor that was a person who was immune to HIV, naturally speaking, which, you know, doesn't happen a lot. And I want to make sure I say that out loud on the radio here so I don't think, you know, people thinking, oh, I'm probably like that. I don't have to worry about HIV. But anyway, they got the donor and they put the bone marrow into this gentleman and it cured both his leukemia and his HIV. Well, obviously that's not practical. Everybody who has HIV can't get a, you know, bone marrow transplant. You know what I mean? But what that did is it helped them learn, right, that this could happen. And so there's been now a couple other cases where they've gone and just did a bone marrow transplant of just a healthy person's bone marrow, not even somebody that was resistant to HIV. Mm-hmm. And they're seeing really positive things. So that's good for the people who are already infected. You know, that's hopeful. Certainly the medications, they've kind of helped and changed some of the formulations so they're not as toxic to the gastrointestinal tract, because I've had just major issues since I've been on medication, which is I've been on meds since 1993 and have had lots and lots of bad side effects and problems. So they've made some advancements there too. If a person can get on a combination therapy that they can tolerate, they can be like how Magic Johnson is, you know, if you can keep your virus really low, in fact, so low that it's kind of, it's so low they can't measure it with their current testing. They call that non-detectable. It doesn't mean that you don't have any virus in your body, but it's non-detectable with their, you know, the sensitivity of the test they have. So that's good because that means there's a lot less virus in your body. And then that means your T cells, which is what HIV attacks, can do their job. And so your T cells stay at a healthy level. And if you can keep that up, then, you know, presumably a person could live perhaps a normal lifespan. The only downside, of course, of the medications, I shouldn't say the only, but one of the obvious ones is that long-term exposure to these medications. And that's where I'm at, okay? I've been taking meds, like I said, for years and years now. And I have both aging going on and HIV in my body, right? HIV is 24/7 attacking, you know, everything it can. So the long-term effects of the medications damage all the vital organs, the heart, the bones, your liver, obviously, you know. As I said, the gastrointestinal tract. So like my heart, they say anybody who's has HIV has been on meds. My heart is 15 years older than my chronological age. So that means right now my heart's 70 years old. Mm-hmm. And because of the medication I'm on, everybody who's on it has really super high triglycerides with the current, the medications that the combination I'm taking. So I have to be on medication now, you know, like Lipitor, that kind of a statin that will, you know, reduce or hopefully help to reduce that. But I can't go off the drugs. I can't go off those meds because then my virus will just, you know, come back stronger than it was before. So, you know, you don't have any choice. And once you're infected with the virus, you have to jump in with both feet, right, and take it seriously and do what you can, you know, to stay as healthy as possible. But it is possible, mm-hmm. which it wasn't, you know, 30 years ago.
Right.
And when I say 30 years ago, oh my God, that sounds like such a long time. And it's over 30 years now since the first cases of HIV in this country.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm. Seems like yesterday almost. Huh?
Yeah. Yeah. For sometimes I look back and it does. It seems very, very like it was very recent. Mm-hmm. And then other days I look back and my life has changed so drastically. And, you know, I'm remarried to a wonderful man and I love what I'm doing. And I never thought I would be here, you mm-hmm. know. And I look back and I think, I wonder if my late husband would even recognize me. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
The person that I am today. Right. It's kind of a weird feeling.
Right. So you must appreciate every day going forward, right?
I do. I do. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I try to give thanks every day in big and small ways and give back to the community. I love doing stuff. I love volunteering, you know, I involve my students as well, but like we do Habitat for Humanity, and you know, that's fun. We get to go down to the soup kitchens down in Detroit. I mean, again, I know that my life is so blessed in comparison to so many other people, mm-hmm. and I'm still here and able to enjoy that. And so I have to, mm-hmm. I have to give back, you know,
right.
it's what keeps me honest. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Right. If someone wanted to get in touch with you, how could they do so?
Well, our website for the Stitches Doll Project is stitchesdollproject.org. So that's pretty easy.
Yeah.
That's the website. We also have an 800 number that I will give you. It's 866. Excuse me. Oh, yeah, 866. I don't have my glasses on. 866 554-2368, and that comes directly to my house. So that would be a great way. And if you go to the website, you can send an email from the website as well. You can reach me also by email at HIVDOLLS, D-O-L-L-S, HIVDOLLS, at Comcast.net. So those are all three ways you can find me.
Okay. Wow. This has really been a powerful interview. I thank you very much, Kathy. I know it's probably not always easy to talk about some of the things you talk about, but thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. And like I said, I really appreciate the opportunity to discuss the issues. I think that we need to do more of that, and I'm very, very happy that you asked me to come on the show. Thanks, Mike.
Okay, well, thank you, Kathy. Okay, wow, I'm just really, really impressed with Kathy and all the things that she's been going through her whole life, or most of her life anyway. Very, very powerful presentation today. Kathy Juris was my guest. She is a professor of sociology at Oakland and Macomb Community Colleges. She is also actively involved in HIV prevention and education, along with being the director of Stitches Women's Initiatives, which is an organization dealing with women's health and safety issues. Like I said, a very powerful interview, so I thank Kathy very much for being here. I want to thank Brandon McKay also for helping me out with another edition of Metaphysically Speaking. I do appreciate his production help. It really means a lot to me. And with all that being said, boy, just take care of yourself. Think for a few minutes before you do something. And with all that being said, have a great day, everybody.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. Welcome to Big Band, Broadway and Beyond. I'm Joe, your host for the next 2 hours. We have a great play for you today. It's Jerome Kern and Oscar Hammerstein's Showboat. And we'll tell you more about it. First of all, the play was, it says, in every medium, printed